So we stopped at about page 60 last time. And this is a pivotal section in which the imagery of the First World War is folded into Hitler's self-presentation as well as into the ideology of the party. And because of our discussion of Remark and his response to the right-wing version of this, where you should be fairly familiar with it, but here it is. I mean, it's a pivotal part of Hitler's self-image as artist and soldier first, and then he becomes politician afterward. And the language he uses is that of that romantic right-wing view of the war, that Remark countered. But instead of having you read Ernst Jünger, I don't know if I could even find it in a paperback, but I probably would if I could, maybe in the future, because I wanted you to get a feel for that, or to know that that's out there, even though we read Remark's anti-war version of it. So here is that language again, page 60. He was joyous upon donning the uniform. My joy and gratitude knew no bounds in the middle of page 60. A few days later, I was wearing the tunic, which I was not to doff until nearly 6 years later. And then we did do this already, but his travel from Munich into the Western Front, he described in very romantic terms, tapping into German landscape and all of the imagery that we could associate with Wagner and a lot of other 19th century nationalistic culture that makes reference to things like the Rhine with its quiet waters, the German stream of streams. When through the tender veil of the early morning mist, the Niederwald monument, one of the monuments that I had up there under the Völkisch 19th century material, gleamed down upon us in the gentle first rays of the sun. Sun, early morning mist. Song, the old watch on the Rhine roared out of the endless transports. So the soldiers are singing this night, War of Liberation song, one of the central military songs of the German tradition. I felt as though my heart would burst. This very romantic, emotional response to that. Very much part of this nationalistic presentation of the war experience. Then came a damp, cold night in Flanders, through which we marched in silence, and when the day began to emerge from the mist, suddenly an iron greeting came whizzing at us over our heads. With a sharp report, sent the little pellets flying between our ranks, ripping up the wet ground. But even before the little cloud had passed from 200 throats, the first hurrah rose to meet the first messenger of death. Very different from the poetry of the First World War that you may know from Siegfried Sassoon or Wilfred Owen, where it's slipping and sliding and trudging up into the trenches. Of course, this is earlier. He's there earlier on, but all the discomfort and the fear and the mess, right? There is this cleansed, romantic view of what it was like to move up to the front. From the distance, the strains of a song reached our ears, coming closer and closer, leaping from company to company, just as death plunged a busy hand into our ranks. A song reached us too, and we passed it along. Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles in der Welt. Right. So the right, they're always singing in the right-wing versions, at least in the early days. This is a consistent trope in their version of the war, whether it be the student volunteers at Langemark in the First World War, or these soldiers going in the Second World War. That whole notion that everybody's really enthusiastic and caught up in it this way. 4 days later, we came back. Even our step had changed. 17-year-old boys now looked like men. So there's that discipline, that hardening process. They've matured as a result of this. They've been not weakened, as Paul Boyma is presented as having done over time, but strengthened through this. The volunteers of the List Regiment may not have learned to fight properly, but they knew how to die like old soldiers, sacrificing yourself for the higher cause. This was the beginning. A little further on, similar stuff. After a year or so, by the winter of 1915, 1916, right, the young volunteer had become an old soldier. All this and this transformation had occurred in the whole army. It had issued old and hard from the eternal battles. As for those who could not stand up under the storm, well, they were broken. Right. So, this strengthening, hardening process again. Thousands of years may pass, but never will it be possible to speak of heroism without mentioning the German army and the World War. Then from the veil of the past, the iron front of the gray steel helmet will emerge, unwavering and unflinching, an immortal monument. Right. So, you've seen him referring to this stuff. You've seen the rituals that kept it alive within the Nazi movement. And, of course, he was a veteran, as he tells you here. So he had, you know, he had justification for presenting him as such. And a lot of the early publicity stills from 1920 or so up till 1923, he definitely looks like the hard front soldier. He's raw boned. He's got his uniform on. You know, they definitely highlighted in that. And I think you have to assume that as puffy and sort of Charlie Chaplin-esque as he appears in most of our minds and later on, right, his self-image was as that hardened soldier. When you deal with older people, you have to remember their self-image is as, you know, a 20-year-old or something like that. And probably we forget then when we deal with that. And I think the same is true as probably in Hitler's case. Okay. Now in 62, he's talking about the political issues back home. This is before the revolution breaks out, but the fact that there's a background of betrayal building up early on. Right? So he's describing his attitudes toward those things. And here we hear this language of very tough measures against opponents. Right? Remember earlier in the city, he saw very early on that we needed a two-pronged attack. We needed discipline and self-control in order to manage our social affairs better, and we need to weed out the problems. Right, so there's always that clarity, which includes the threat of violent action. And the language of extermination and rooting things out, right, is there. So, page 62. Right. There were perjuring criminals organizing the revolution, he's anticipating. These parties should have been dissolved. The Reichstag should have been brought to his senses with bayonets, if necessary. But best of all, dissolved at once. So anti-democratic, anti-parliamentary. The application of force alone, without the impetus of a basic spiritual idea as a starting point, can never lead to the destruction of an idea and its dissemination, except in the form of a complete extermination of the very last exponent of the idea and the destruction of the last tradition. That's a really fuzzy translation, but still, you want to completely destroy the opponent. And cultural historians look to the First World War for the source of that kind of an attitude. I mean, this is the notion of that brutalization of political culture. You don't just defeat your enemy, you wipe your enemy out without any qualms. A little further on, the complete annihilation of the new doctrine can be carried out only through a process of extermination so great and constantly increasing that in the end all the truly valuable blood is drawn out of the people or state in question. So, I mean, this kind of this is 1923-24. We can assume that a lot of this language was already part of speeches that he had given before he dictated this. This is the kind of material that intentionalists read and say, you know, how could you not have assumed that this is what was leading toward the Holocaust? Okay, let's move to page 65, which is under the title War Propaganda. And what he's looking at is the propaganda, obviously during the First World War, and the lessons that he drew from that. So, influence of the war, but in the construction of this whole style, this look, this method that he creates in order to to convince the voters. Bottom of 65. Propaganda in war is a means to an end, and the end was a struggle for the existence of the German people, which, of course, he thinks his struggle continues to be. Consequently, propaganda could only be considered in accordance with the principles that were valid for this struggle. In this case, the most cruel weapons were humane if they brought about a quicker victory. So the most cruel methods of propaganda are valid. Only those methods were beautiful which helped the nation to safeguard the dignity of its freedom. Which is basically a blank check. You can say and do anything in propaganda if it's in the interest of your cause. 66, very famous, extensive passage here. The whole art of propaganda consists in doing this so skillfully that everyone will be convinced that the fact is real, the process necessary, the necessity correct. But since propaganda is not and cannot be the necessity itself, since its function, like the poster, consists in attracting the attention of the crowd and not in educating those who are already educated, or who are striving after education and knowledge, its effect for the most part must be aimed at the emotions and only to a very limited degree at the so-called intellect. So, I mean, here it is. He's spelling it out. We're not trying to convince anybody. All of this is designed in order to hit you in your guts, not in your mind. So this imagery of the language and as well as the ritual, he's very aware that that's what it's designed to do. All propaganda must be popular, so for the general people, the populace. And its intellectual level must be adjusted to the most limited intelligence among those it is addressed to. Right? So you're going, he's saying, we're going for the lowest common denominator here. Right? Hit them with swords and flames and songs and marching and in essence, go after the 13-year-old boy and all of them. That's what works. Consequently, the greater the mass it is intended to reach, the lower its purely intellectual level will have to be. The more modest its intellectual ballast, the more exclusively it takes into consideration the emotions of the masses, the more effective it will be. So you don't listen to a Hitler speech for information. That's not the point, right? You go there for that emotional impact. The art of propaganda lies in understanding the emotional ideas of the great masses and finding through a psychologically correct form the way to the attention and thence to the heart of the broad masses. The fact that our bright boys, the clever Jews, right, the smart politicians, do not understand this merely shows how mentally and lazy and conceited they are. And of course, the scary thing is that he was right. You know, it worked. If you go at him with too much information, then people just get bored. Once we understand how necessary it is for propaganda to be adjusted to the broad mass, the following rule results. It is a mistake to make propaganda many-sided, like scientific instruction, for instance. The receptivity of the great masses is very limited, their intelligence is small, but their power of forgetting is enormous. In consequence of these facts, all effective propaganda must be limited to a very few points, and must harp on these in slogans until the last member of the public understands what you want him to understand by your slogan. As soon as you sacrifice this slogan and try to be many-sided, the effect will piddle away, for the crowd can neither digest nor retain the material offered. In this way, the result is weakened and the end entirely canceled out. So there's so many ways in which his language and their general propaganda applied this. But, you know, the obvious ones being focus on one target, keep hammering at away at it. Don't make it complicated. It's the Jew. That's the problem. And simple answers to these problems. Right? And it provides that sense of clarity as well as this emotional comprehensibility. And I mean, he spells it out right here. 67. The function of propaganda is not to weigh and ponder the rights of different people, but exclusively to emphasize the one right which it is set out to argue for. So you don't worry about, you know, what other people might think about it. Its task is not to make an objective study of the truth, insofar as it favors the enemy, and then set it before the masses with academic fairness. Its task is to serve our own right, always and unflinchingly. So just pick that enemy, pick that position, and never relent. At the bottom, the most brilliant propagandist technique will yield no success unless one fundamental principle is borne in mind constantly and with unflagging attention. It must confine itself to a few points and repeat them over and over. Which, of course, he does here, right? And you're experiencing the sense of that. But this is the method behind the madness. And he may seem like he's going crazy and just screaming and out of control and so on and so forth, and that has tremendous emotional impact, but he knows what he's doing. Okay. Now, after this interlude on what he learned from war propaganda, starting on page 73, we have the last phases of the war and his experiences of them. And probably the most famous, but by no means the only articulation of this stab in the back legend. I'll pick up page 74, I guess. In the fall of 1918, we stood for the third time on the storm site of 1914. So they've moved ahead some. On the night of October 13, the English gas attack on the southern front before Ypres burst loose. They used Yellow Cross gas, whose effects were still unknown to us as far as personal experience was concerned. In this same night, I myself was to become acquainted with it. On a hill south of Vevic, we came on the evening of October 13 into several hours of drum fire with gas shells, which continued all night more or less violently. As early as midnight, a number of us passed out, a few of our comrades forever. Toward morning, I, too, was seized with pain, which grew worse with every quarter hour, and at 7 in the morning, I stumbled and tottered back with burning eyes, taking with me my last report of the war. A few hours later, my eyes had turned into glowing coals. It had grown dark around me. Thus I came to the hospital in Pomerania, and there I was fated to experience the greatest villainy of the century. So he experienced gas directly. One day, suddenly and unexpectedly, the calamity descended. Sailors arrived in trucks and proclaimed the revolution. A few Jewish youths, of course he had to throw that in, were the leaders in this struggle for the freedom, beauty, and dignity of our national existence. None of them had been at the front. By the way of a so-called gonorrhea hospital, the three... I have to work to get my brain around some of this. The three Orientals been sent... I'm glad to say that I do. I have to get work at it. The three Orientals had been sent back home for their second-line base. Now they raise the red flag, the red rag in the homeland. Okay, so that's his description of how he got word that things had changed. Yep.
If he's on the Western Front fighting the English, how does he wake up in a hospital in Pomerania?
Trains.
But is that prudent and strategic as far as hospitals are concerned?
I can't answer that.
Okay. It is just like really, really weird that...
Well, I don't know. I mean, our troops are ending up in Germany from Iraq, so I guess it's
but
the equivalent of that.
That's entirely different.
So it had all been in vain. I don't know the answer.
Okay.
Yeah. In vain all the sacrifices and privations. In vain the hunger and thirst of months, which were often endless. In vain the hours in which, with mortal fear clutching at our hearts, we nevertheless did our duty, and in vain the death of 2 million who died. Would not the graves of all the hundreds of thousands open, the graves of those who with faith in the fatherland had marched forth never to return? Okay. So here's that whole, here's the origins of that ritual in the labor front rally, right, with the flags. Would that they would come back alive. Would that those fallen comrades would return. Had they died for this, the soldiers of August and September 1914? Was it for this that in the autumn of the same year the volunteer regiments marched after their old comrades? Was it for this that these boys of 17 sank into the earth of Flanders? Was this the meaning of the sacrifice which the German mother made to the fatherland when with a sore heart she let her best-loved boys march off, never to see them again? Did all this happen only so that a gang of wretched criminals could lay hands on the fatherland? So there's the language of that betrayed soldier. Probably universal among soldiers who lose, but he's definitely a strong representative of that. Was it for this that the German soldier had stood host in the sun's heat and snowstorms, hungry, thirsty, and freezing, weary from sleepless nights and endless marches? Was it for this that he had lain in the hell of the drum fire and the fever pits of, and the fever of gas attacks, without wavering, always thoughtful of his one duty to preserve the fatherland from the enemy peril? There followed terrible days and even worse nights. I knew that all was lost. Only fools, liars, and criminals could hope in the mercy of the enemy. In these nights, hatred grew in me. Hatred for those responsible for this deed. Okay, so he's going to latch on to a particular enemy responsible for all of this. Right? And in the last line here, it's clear what it was. There is no making pacts with Jews. There can only be the hard either or. I, for my part, decided to go into politics. So, he's done it before in his personal failure, attempting to get into art school, ended up blaming the Jews. And then with the end of the war, it's there again. So, he goes back to Munich, and he's involved with this party as an observer. Talks a little bit about that. Right? And then on page 79, we start to hear this program developing. Of course, it's in retrospect. For me and all true National Socialists, there is but one doctrine, people and fathers. So there's that simplification thing, that language that you just heard in the speech. What we must fight for is to safeguard the existence and reproduction of our race and our people, the sustenance of our children and the purity of our blood, the freedom and the independence of the fatherland, so that our people may mature for the fulfillment of the mission allotted it by the Creator of the universe. Every thought and every idea, every doctrine and all knowledge must serve this purpose. There's that, you know, if you step into this worldview, everything's clear. You have one doctrine, defense of the people and the fatherland. You have one enemy, the Jews, and you have, you know, a clear path of action, a clear worldview. Everything must be examined from this point of view and used or rejected according to its utility. And that line sort of describes what, for the hardliners, for those who really take the pill and immerse their personalities and believe in it to the end, even when 40 years later, you know, an intelligent documentary filmmaker is saying, you threw, you know, French babies up against the wall. Do you have no remorse at all? And they, nope. Because they, that provided them with their secure framework to live by. And if they let go of it, they'll be out there again, as one person said, where there is gnashing of teeth. I didn't get the whole quote. But. Okay, so just an aside, because he pointed it out, and I mentioned that it wasn't quite true. On page 83, here's where he claims that he was the seventh member of the party, which he suggests, but it would pre-existed him. There were 500 or so members when he was around already. He was and as my notes say here on the side, he was actually number 7 on the executive committee, and I think he was number 55 was his card. So it's just his playing that, you know, he picks and chooses what he wants, and he wants everybody to think there were only 7 of us when we started this. It was a little bit bigger than that. Now skip ahead a ways to, what else did I highlight here? Of course, you have the notes and you can look through and see a lot more. But let's move ahead to page 95. Now he's talked about the problems of the collapse of the old Weimar world. But I'm highlighting, because you may not hear this elsewhere, his concern, his particular personal concern with the cultural collapse. That's what bothers him intensely, as well as the other things. Middle of 95. One of the most obvious manifestations of decay in the Old Reich was the slow decline of the cultural level. And by culture, I do not mean what today is designated by the word civilization. He's talking about a spiritual degeneration that had reached the point of destroying the spirit. In them, the political collapse, which later became more visible, was culturally indicated. So the culture was falling apart earlier, and he claims to have been sensitive about that. Art Bolshevism is the only possible cultural form and spiritual expression of Bolshevism as a whole. So he's putting these things together, right? Bolshevism, modernist art, Jewishness, right? That's all being transformed into this single problem, linking it all together, creating that single enemy. 60 years ago, an exhibition of so-called Dadaist experiments would have seemed simply impossible, and its organizers would have ended up in the madhouse, while today they even preside over art associations. This plague could not appear at that time because neither would public opinion have tolerated it or the state calmly looked on. So the fact that Dadaism emerged was an indication of the decay, the moral, spiritual decay of Germany as a whole. Once we pass through the development of our cultural life in the last 25 years, from this standpoint, we shall be horrified to see how far we are already engaged in this regression. Everywhere we encounter seeds which represent the beginnings of parasitic growths, which must sooner or later be the ruin of our culture. In them, we can recognize the symptoms of decay of a slowly rotting world. Woe to the peoples who can no longer master this disease. Such diseases could be seen in Germany in nearly every field of art and theater, of art and culture. So that language, a medical language of disease and rotting out from the inside, an infection, he uses that to describe artistic modernism. And we talked last time about what he prefers, that classicism tinged with romanticism as well. Over on page 96 at the bottom. The saddest thing about the state of our whole culture of pre-war period was not only the total impotence of artistic and cultural creative power in general, but the hatred with which the memory of the greater pest was besmirched and effaced. In nearly all fields of art, especially in the theater and literature, we began around the turn of the century to produce less that was new and significant, but to disparage the best of the old work and represented it as inferior and surpassed. So, according to him, he will protect tradition. He'll protect the grand achievements of Western art as a whole, going back to the Greeks. And he sees, of course, the modernists as rejecting that completely. On page 97, something he's particularly interested in, monumental architecture in the cities. These are the things that he likes, and ultimately it's very interested in building himself. And he talks about at the beginning of top 97, this main section in the middle. In the 19th century, our cities began more and more to lose the character of cultural sites and descend more to the level of mere human settlements. It didn't have the great monuments of earlier civilizations. A couple paragraphs down. All our cities are living on the fame and treasures of the past. For instance, take from present-day Munich everything that was created under Ludwig I, and you will note with horror how poor the addition of significant artistic creations has been since that time. The same is true of Berlin and most other big cities. The essential point is the following. Our big cities today possess no monuments dominating the city picture, which might somehow be regarded as the symbols of the whole epoch. Okay. Now, I should have set this up, and I will at the break, but he had plans for changing that. This is what he's tinkering with. There's a book out there that argues, and I think he pushes it too far, but in the back of Hitler's mind, the real reason to push for German dominance of Central Europe and ultimately resources in Eastern Europe and Russia and so on was just so that he could build these monuments, right? Now, I think that pushing it, I mean, Lebensraum and so on were very real issues to him. There's no doubt about that. But he certainly did intend to take advantage, and that was going to be his personal mission, was to build this new triumphal arch and to build this new dome and to build the new chancellery and build opera houses, two opera houses in every major German city, one for not Wagner and one for Wagner. That was his thing, and I'll show you. You've seen them, but maybe not in this context. Okay, now let's go to page 105, where we get some more direct articulation of the whole racial theory and application of it in in the political framework, nation and race. Now, we've heard quite a bit about the Jews, and we'll hear more about it, but the other side of it was the strength of the Germans. That's very much part of this. And we don't get as much as some of those who survived the 19th century got in terms of this articulation that the Aryan race, which they trace back to India and sweeps west through Greece, just in time for the Hellenic Age in Greece, and sweeps through Italy just in time for the High Renaissance, right? By the way, also responsible for the best of Gothic architecture and so on, is the only creative race, the only truly creative race. And of course, in artistic world, the Jews are the opposite of creative. They're just imitators. They don't create anything new. They're dry, desert people. They don't construct anything. So there's this duality. But here's some of that language of the pro-Aryan. we'll just move to page 107, where the stronger statement of that appears. All human culture, all the results of art, science, and technology that we see before us today are almost exclusively the product of the Aryan. This very fact admits of the not founded inference that he alone was the founder of all higher humanity, therefore representing the prototype of all that we understand by the word man. He is the Prometheus of mankind, from whose bright forehead the divine spark of genius has sprung at all times, forever kindling anew that fire of knowledge which illumined the night of silent mysteries and thus caused man to climb the path to mastery over the other beings of this earth. So here's the justification. Why are you working so hard to defend the Aryan? Because they're the only creative element in all of humanity. They define what man is. I don't think I can explain it anymore. There's only so much I can do. And of course, starting on 110, the mightiest counterpart to the Aryan is represented by the Jew. And just more on this as a cultural problem. And here we do hear some of the language that he wouldn't necessarily have had to pick up from Wagner, but it's definitely traceable to the same roots that Wagner's was. Bottom of page 111. Hence the Jewish people, despite all apparent intellectual qualities, so they look clever. So he's got a problem. The Jews are very clever. The Jews are highly represented in intellectual pursuits in the art world, in law, and so on and so forth. How do you explain that if the Aryans are the only creative one? Right? So they've got to come up with some sort of explanation for that. What a sham the Jew today possesses is the property of other peoples. What sham culture the Jew today possesses is the property of other peoples. And for the most part, it is ruined in his hands. In judging the Jewish people's attitude on the question of human culture, the most essential characteristic we must always bear in mind is that there has never been a Jewish art, and accordingly, there is none today either. That above the two queens of all the arts, architecture and music, his two favorites, owe nothing original to the Jews. What they do accomplish in the field of art is either patchwork or intellectual theft. Thus, the Jew lacks those qualities which distinguish the races that are creative and hence culturally blessed. So, you know, it's backloading his position. He's got to, you know, he has this view, and he has to try to explain why it is that Jews are such a threat to the culture that he loves so much. Okay, so responsible for artistic modernism and those problems, 117, back to politics. Now I'm jumping around, but frankly he jumps around too. So you're not losing too much of the narrative by sketching around like this. And here we go to the point we were talking about last time, which is, you know, he's blaming him for contradictory things. And you just have to, I mean, that's how it works. You lump it all onto one enemy. While on the one hand he organized the capitalistic methods of human exploitation to their ultimate consequence, so he's responsible for capitalism and he causes all the problems in that modern capitalist world. He also approaches the very victims of his spirit and his activity, and in a short time becomes the leader of their struggle against himself. So he's also responsible for communism and socialism's struggle against capitalism. Right, so there's a sentence that really embodies that contradictory thing, that you can say that in one sentence, right, and still get away with it. But it works because it's that simplification of a problem. Right. He organizes capitalistic methods of human exploitation, then he goes to the victims and organizes them to struggle against his capitalistic exploitation. Right. So, politics, art, right, and that's not enough, page 119, now we're going to really go for the gut. With satanic joy in his face, the black-haired Jewish youth lurks in wait for the unsuspecting girl whom he defiles with his blood, thus stealing her from her people. With every means, he tries to destroy the racial foundations of the people he has set out to subjugate. Just as he himself systematically ruins women and girls, he does not shrink back from pulling down the blood barriers for others, even on a grand scale. It was and is Jews who bring the Negroes into the Rhineland. Do you know what that's about? The French used African soldiers. Yeah. And, you know, when they occupied the Rhineland, there were Senegalese soldiers there. Right. There's a side there, but I'm not going to go. always with the same secret thought and clear aim of ruining the hated white race by necessarily resulting bastardization, throwing it down from its cultural and political height, and himself rising to be the master. Right. So, if you didn't get it before, here it comes again. In politics, he begins to replace the idea of democracy by dictatorship of the proletariat. Okay, so he's responsible for that. In economics, he undermines the states until social enterprises, which have become unprofitable, are taken from the state and subjected to its financial control. So he's big business. Culturally, he contaminates art, literature, the theater, makes a mockery of natural feeling, overthrows all concepts of beauty and sublimity, of the noble and the good, and instead drags man down into the sphere of his own base nature. Religion is ridiculed, ethics and morality represented as outmoded, until the last props of a nation in its struggle for existence in this world have fallen. So, they're responsible for everything. Middle of page 120, all really significant symptoms of decay of the pre-war period can in the last analysis be reduced to racial causes. Whether we consider the questions of general justice or cankers of economic life, symptoms of cultural decline or processes of political degeneration, questions of faulty schooling or the bad influence exerted on grown-ups by the press, everywhere and always, it is fundamentally the disregard of our racial needs of our own people or failure to see a foreign racial menace. So, on the basis of this inner realization at the end of page 121, there took form in our new movement the leading principles as well as the tendency which in our conviction were alone capable not only of halting the decline of the German people, but of creating the granite foundation upon which someday a state will rest, which represents not an alien mechanism of economic concerns and interests, but a national organism. Right? So in response, again, in response to all those problems, which he's actually trying to simplify down into a single problem, right, we have this granite foundation, which is not going to be a complicated mechanism of economic concerns and interests. In other words, I'm not going to tell you all the details, right, but just present this notion of a German state of the German nation. So very clear and orderly. Now, let's just take a few minutes. I'm almost done with what I want to lead you through here, and then we'll take a break. Just a couple more points. Starting on page 124, you have here this much vaunted by him party program, reduced to 25 points. So he does have, here's the brochure that he sends out. Here are the 25 points that we're going to govern by. And although it's more, you know, extensive than some of the, just the basic principles we've covered here, it includes those. It is that notion of getting things down to this. And he holds to these 25 points pretty much through his whole, you know, speaking career. These are the main talking points that he holds to. And I'll just pick out a few of those. But he was very proud of himself for having reduced this more complicated platform that the NSDAP had before he turned it into the NSDAP. The nationalization of the broad masses on page 124 can never be achieved by half measures, by weakly emphasizing a so-called objective standpoint, but only by a ruthless and fanatically one-sided orientation toward the goal to be achieved. That's one of his points, right? Is that we're just going to, you know, use this single-minded, one-sided language and orientation toward this. A little further on, under 4, the nationalization of our masses will succeed only when, aside from all the positive struggle for the soul of our people, their international poisoners are exterminated. Right? There it is. The enemies have to be exterminated. International poisoners. Well, who do you think they are? All great questions of the day are questions of the moment and represent only consequences of definite causes. Only one among all of them, however, possesses causal importance. Land, and that is a question of the racial preservation of the nation. And so he places the race issue right in the center of these things. The goal of a political reform movement will never be reached by enlightenment work. Right, so anti-intellectual, diplomacy, anti-democratic, or by influencing ruling circles. So he's against the old cliques, which he does supplant, but only by the achievement of political power. So you have to get control. Every world-moving idea has not only the right, but the duty of securing those means which make possible the execution of its ideas. Success is the one earthly judge concerning the right or wrong of such an effort. So, ends justify the means, right? But action. We're going to take action. We're not going to sit around and talk about it. We're not going to try to convince people. We're not going to, work to educate and enlighten people over time. We're going to take action. Very refreshing to people who've remember, coming out of the Franz Bieberkopf world of confusion, we need order, we need someone to take charge, right? The young movement is in its nature and inner organization anti-parliamentarian, right? So, against democracy. It rejects in general and in its own inner structure a principle of majority rule in which the leader is degraded to the level of the mere executant of other people's will and opinion, right? So, leader principle. The president isn't just going to do what Parliament tells him to do. He's going to make real decisions. In little things, as well as big things, the movement advocates the principle of a Germanic democracy. The leader is elected, but then enjoys unconditional authority. And, you know, that's sort of the way it plays out. So he's writing this in 1924. In 1934, that's the way at least they're going to present themselves as having been duly, legally placed in power, but then we're going to remove any restrictions on his power through the Enabling Act, and he'll be able to rule with absolutely. And then I think I'll stop here. almost. Two more. 127. Leader principle. Any man who wants to be a leader bears, along with the highest unlimited authority, also the ultimate and heaviest responsibility. Anyone who is not equal to this or is too cowardly to bear the consequences of his acts is not fit to be leader. Only the hero is cut out for this. Of course, that's what he's presenting himself as being. And finally, on page 135, I took up the program, this program, and began to explain it for the first time. And here he describes, once he's consolidated things in this way, organized things, given to this clear, linear delineation, as opposed to all the complexities of other party programs, and even the German Workers' Party before that. When he presents it to the party, from minute to minute, the interruptions were increasingly drowned out by shouts of applause. And when I finally submitted the 25 theses, point for point, to the masses, and asked them, this would have been at one of the beer hall meetings, right, and asked them personally to pronounce judgment on them, one after another was accepted with steadily mounting joy. So here's that emotional thing, Wagnerian experience. Unanimously, and again unanimously, and then when the last thesis had found its way into the heart of the masses, not their brain, so this is this party, there stood before me a hall full of people united by a new conviction, a new faith, right, and a new will. So there's the secular religious language, is a new faith I provided here, the 25 commandments. When after nearly 4 hours, the hall began to empty and the crowd, shoulder to shoulder, began to move, shove, pressed toward the exit like a slow stream. There's that kind of romantic water language. I knew now that the principles of a movement which could no longer be forgotten were moving out among the German people. A fire was kindled from whose flame one day the sword must come, which would regain freedom for the German Siegfried, Wagner, and life for the German nation. The movement took its course. There's that whole notion of creating something organic and unleashing it in a way that, you know, wouldn't rest until all of its aims were achieved, right? Even if that means marching up to Moscow. And all that in 1924 already, 10 years before he's in power. So we'll talk a little bit about how we got there and then set things up for what we'll talk about next time.